Hey there, hope you're doing really, really good today. And welcome to this episode where we're gonna go over, I think there are four emails and maybe two comments that we are gonna talk about. First of all, thanks everyone that has contributed by sending questions. That is vital to this channel. And I hope it'll really help anyone that tunes in here. And before we go to these questions, quick disclaimer, nothing here is medical advice or personal advice to anyone, just general thoughts, general advice that applies to anyone with the same type of problems that the person that is asking the question has. So that said, let me grab my glasses and we should actually start with an email that came in very recently from Amber. Let's see if I can find it. Here it is. So this is an email from Amber. Title: Insomnia Sufferer, Need Help or Advice. Let's read this. So this came in 5 hours ago. Hi Daniel, I recently found your channel. I wanted to send you an email because nobody else seems to be able to help. I want to tell you a bit about my problem with insomnia. I have to be honest to tell you that I have a history of drug use, all kinds of drug use. I stopped using drugs in 2017. However, I started using kratom and drinking wine in the evenings. I recently stopped using kratom because it started having opposite effects of what it usually did. I also stopped drinking. One day when I took kratom, it caused this ringing in my brain and this hyper arousal it never caused before. I began to be unable to sleep and felt like I was on a really bad speed trip. I continued to take kratom because of this physical withdrawal, stopping it. It caused, but every time I did, the ringing got louder and insomnia got worse. I also wasn't able to eat. I went 6 days with no sleep before I knew I had to quit using it or I felt like it would kill me. I always thought kratom was safe because it's a natural herbal supplement. Boy, was I wrong. Fast forward, I've been off kratom for 3 weeks today. However, the ringing in my brain is still there and I'm literally unable to sleep without powerful drugs. The doctor gave me Seroquel, 400 milligrams for insomnia, but I also have to take melatonin, 6 milligrams with it to fall asleep for just a few hours. It is not deep sleep, and I wake up 4 hours later. My brain feels stuck in a state of hyperarousal all the time, and I don't feel tired when I'm awake. The ringing noise is always there, and my body is sore, and I yawn, but I cannot get sleepy like in my brain on my own. I just want to fall asleep naturally, but physically cannot. Last night, I tried not taking the Seroquel because Seroquel is a horrible drug to see if I could sleep, and I did not. I'm so mad at myself because I feel I've damaged my brain beyond repair because of all the years I've used my body with drugs. I'm also scared of the damage Seroquel may be doing, but nothing else helps me sleep, not even Ambien. I started kratom because everyone said it was safe and would stop cravings for other drugs and boost my mood naturally. It also used to help me sleep very soundly until one day it didn't. Now I'd give anything to undo the damage done. The reason I'm writing to you is to ask if it is possible that this insomnia may be permanent. Could neurotoxicity be possible for insomnia? Could it be brain damage? Do you think a neurotransmitter imbalance is possible? I'm so scared I'll never sleep again or be normal again. I don't mean to get so personal, but I'm desperate for help and don't really know which direction to go. I wanted to be honest so you could give me an honest opinion. I feel like a complete loser. I don't know why, but I don't know about any of this. If you don't know anything about this, that's okay too. Thank you for your time. So, firstly, Amber, thanks for reaching out. And I also often say that it's so helpful getting questions like this because I'm sure there's a bunch of other people with very similar questions that what I'm would will help not only you, Amber, but so many other people. So thank you for that. And now a lot of things to talk about here. I feel, let's start where I actually often start, which is to talk about like how insomnia develops, why we get insomnia. And I'm going to talk about something called the 3P model. Some of you may have heard this before, and you can skip ahead if you want to, but I think it's super important actually. So there are 3 Ps here. The first P stands for predisposed, the second for precipitating factors, and the third for like perpetuating factors. So the first P just is predisposed. It's some of us are just a little bit more likely to have trouble sleeping at some point. And if you are a little bit anxious, tend to worry, if you're hyper organized, if you're type A, you're high strung, if you're like very health conscious, if you're If you're kind of an overthinker, overanalyze things, those things makes it more likely that you at some point will develop insomnia. Now, the important thing there is that there are millions of people out there who have many of these traits and they're just fine because nothing happened, nothing triggered insomnia. So think about yourself and see if you fit. And most of you out there will probably find that, yeah, I do fit that to some degree, I do fit. And by the way, if you've always had a little bit of trouble sleeping, that in itself is like, tells us that you have a little bit of predisposition towards insomnia. But again, that in itself is not a problem. Something has to trigger insomnia. And in this case with Amber here, there's a lot of things that's happening that's been stressful that could trigger insomnia. But that itself is, again, not the problem, if you will, because when things that are stressful happen to us, we are supposed to not sleep well. You know, imagine that I always use this type of example, like imagine we're living outside in the wild. It's the year, you know, 250 BC. And, you know, we hear that a warring tribe is nearby or whatever. Like, it's good for us not to sleep well. We have to be on the lookout for this external threat. So reacting that way, like when we're stressed, we're quote unquote supposed not to sleep well. That is normal. That's a normal reaction. But when we learn that that warring tribe was actually a peaceful tribe, we're supposed to kind of, okay, now we can sleep good again. So that's, you know, what quote unquote is supposed to happen. And this leads us to the third P, which is like the perpetuating factors, which is the reaction to the insomnia. Like, let's say somebody has a stretch of 6 weeks of not sleeping at all, and then starts to like really identify that this is a threat, this is a problem, I can't sleep, something is wrong, and then starts thinking about this and saying, I have to try this, I'm going to try this. That helped initially, but now stopped helping, so now I have to try this other thing, and that didn't help, now I try this, this seemed to help, but I'm not sure. All this like trying, all the thinking about it, all the preoccupation, all the worrying about not sleeping is ultimately what fuels insomnia and makes it and takes it from like a sleep disturbance, like a couple of days or nights we don't sleep very well or much at all, takes it from there to chronic insomnia. That's how insomnia develops. So what we really can learn here is that the third P, those perpetuating factors, we can reverse that whole process when we start, you know, we start understanding why we have insomnia. We start doing less to produce sleep. We start thinking less about sleep. We start shifting attention away from sleep. That is the first really important step towards, you know, sleeping well. So that's kind of just a big framework that I think is good. It's actually good to start almost every episode with that because that's so important. So in the case of Amber here, we already talked about the fact that there was a lot of things that could have triggered insomnia, and we also can hear, we're going to go into more detail here, but overall the secretin, the melatonin, Ambien, like Amber's tried many things to sleep better, and all those things that we try to produce sleep ultimately make it harder actually to sleep better. But another couple of very important things here that I think applies to so many people is this element of like blaming oneself, you know, having empathy with oneself, self-love, self-care is really important, because that, you know, it's not helpful to just to blame oneself. And that doesn't really lead to a place of like where you feel good about yourself and ready to work on, in this case, sleeping better. I'm sure there were many reasons for you having, you know, using drugs and just, you know, exercising self-love is a really important step. That's one important thing I wanted to mention here as I was reading this. Another really important thing here is, no, you cannot destroy, you know, the part of your brain that regulates sleep. You cannot cause permanent damage to the neurotransmitters in your brain. That doesn't happen. It's like breathing. Like you can do all kinds of things to your body, but you can't lose the ability to breathe. You know, you can't lose the ability to sleep. You can't even affect the centers in the brain that regulate sleep. But here's a very important thing. Like the concern about that, the belief that something is wrong in your sleep system, that belief is very damaging. That belief can cause a lot of insomnia, and very often does. And for those of you who have listened to a lot of my episodes, you probably recognize phrases from this email almost like word by word. People so often feel exactly that. I've damaged my brain. My neurotransmitters are wrong. There's some odd hormonal imbalance in my body that's causing me to sleep. That's not the thing. It is the belief that this is happening that is the real problem. And just in terms of, like, I often talk about how we need to kind of work with beliefs and challenge beliefs. And in this case, it is, I think, the best thing to kind of challenge this belief is almost like, you know, head on, like, you know, no, that cannot happen. You cannot damage your brain. You cannot cause, you know, disruption to neurotransmitters that cause permanent insomnia. No, that cannot happen. Now, that said, let's go on to some more things. Like this whole thing with a kratom and the ringing in the ear, I don't know anything particular about that. A lot of other things are very, you know, my brain is stuck in hyperarousal, very common with insomnia, of course. I want to sleep naturally, but I cannot. All these things are very, very typical insomnia type symptoms. Now, let's see. I think we answered a lot of this, but let's see. Let's go become getting a little more practical here. I think I talked about the things I felt like I really want to talk about here, except for this then. So how do you move forward? Well, when somebody is taking medications for insomnia but actually wants to get off those medications and sleep naturally, it's hard to do many things at the same time. And medications themselves are not they don't necessarily stand in the way of somebody getting to sleeping well, except when there's a belief problem again. If somebody believes that medication is making them sleep, that can be a problem. Not initially, actually. It can be a problem when you try to get off the medication. And to take a step back from that, it's important to know that the only thing that can actually produce sleep is your own natural sleep drive, which I've started using that as like the gas analogy. Like, if you stay awake for a long time, you build a strong sleep drive. You really need to sleep, and that's kind of the gas in the system that wants to make you sleep. Then we have the brake system, which is like worry, anxiety, unhelpful beliefs, and things like that, and hyperarousal. And that hyperarousal, the brake can be really, really strong, so strong that you don't even feel your sleepiness. You know, you never even feel sleepy because the hyperarousal is so, you know, the gas is like pressed all the way down. And now, how can you get past this? Well, there are many ways, or a couple of ways, let's say. There are really two ways, right? Either you let off the gas, let off the brake, or you gas more, right? And what most people want to do is get rid of the brake. Like, I want to feel more relaxed. I want to get rid of the hyperarousal, you know, which is harder to do actually than giving more gas. Giving more gas is the classic CBTI technique of what's called sleep restriction, unfortunately, or bedtime restriction, or what I've started to call to sleep tight, which basically just is spending less time in bed and spending more time in like active, happy, and joyful wakefulness. So how do you do that practically? Well, you get up early and the same time every day. That consistent wake up time is really early because that's the anchor around which a sleep cycle can evolve, you know, a sleep pattern can evolve, or the sun, the central point around which everything else circulates. So getting up, let's say 6 a.m., is I'm just taking numbers, 6 a.m. is good. So let's say you decide, I'm gonna get up 6 a.m. every single day. Even if I had a terrible night and I didn't sleep at all, I'm not gonna try to sleep in or compensate for that, which is not a good strategy. I'm gonna get up at 6 a.m. every single day. And not only that, I'm gonna avoid sleeping during the day, and I'm gonna do things that I enjoy. I'm gonna start a new project, or I'm gonna, anything that you like to do is what you should be doing during the day. And then don't go to bed late. Go to bed like not before midnight. And if you don't feel sleepy at midnight, then you wait even later, you know? And yes, there could be a night where you finally, you went to bed, you didn't feel sleep until, you know, 3:30, and then you fell asleep and you slept 2 hours until 5:30. Well, yes, you have to get up at 6 again and stay up until 12. Eventually, you'll start feeling the gas. And when you do, that's a big deal. When that day happens, and it usually happens in the first 1 to 2 weeks, when you feel that, whoa, I'm feeling sleepy. I haven't felt sleepy in a long time. It's working. The system is working. You know, hold on to that. And then we start like, I woke up, I fell back asleep. That's awesome. These are the stepping stones, or like, you know, in climbing wall, these are kind of the grips, you know, this is what kind of pull you can use to pull up all these little positive signs in the beginning. And then, and so medication wise, I think for most people, the best thing to do is just take the medication you're on at the same time every night without questioning it. Like, I'm going to take the same medication at 11 p.m. no matter what. I'm just going to not question that until you've gotten to a point where you have sleep confidence, where you're like, you know what, I can sleep. I see that. I believe it. Then it's not so hard to start tapering off the medication. But also knowing that your sleep drive is the only thing that produces sleep is the first step towards transferring sleep confidence from the outside to the inside. So all those things are, I think, are really, really important. So Amber, hang in there, stay in touch. Follow-up questions, things I missed, please just send me another email, and rooting for you. Okay, that said, let's actually jump over to, there was a mentioning of melatonin here, and I wanted to comment on a comment from Gabrielle, and this is a comment on episode 59, actually episode pod 59, and Amber said the following. Awesome, thanks. Also, to help me continue with building my sleep confidence, how long does 1 milligram of melatonin tend to last in the body? I'm average weight, about 130 pounds. I take it at 10:30. I wake up in the middle of the night about 1 to 2 times, but fall back asleep. I'm hoping it's me and not still the effect of the pill that's making me sleep, LOL. And here's the thing. Melatonin, as I said, actually commenting kind of briefly there on Gabriella's comment, melatonin 1 milligram is like, you know, it's something that you would give to like a, you know, 3-year-old, you know? Not that there are no established guidelines or dosage recommendation, no established recommendations for how much melatonin one should take, but melatonin is produced in our own body. It is not known as a effective hypnotic, you know, hypnotic, it should really be called like sedative. Like most medications, really all sleep medications work by, you know, making you sedated and groggy. So they take away a little bit of that break, you know, they make you a little bit kind of like relaxed, if you will, and then they allow your body to sleep. Melatonin, to be honest with you, I think it has zero to extremely minimal like hypnotic effects. And at 1 milligram, I really don't think it affects anybody to any significant extent. So the big point here, I think, is that melatonin, I really don't think makes a difference. But the thinking about like, should I take 1 milligram or 3 milligrams? I'm 130 pounds. I take it at the therapy. What's the half-life? Maybe I should take it later. Maybe I should take it earlier. Maybe I should take double. Maybe I should take this. That can often be a problem, you know? The melatonin itself, you can take it or not take it, doesn't matter. But if you think about it, if you wonder and query and question and experiment, that can cause a lot of insomnia. So I think, again, like either you decide like, yep, yeah, I'm going to take it every night at this time and not think about it, not question it or whatever, that's perfect. Or you decide I'm not going to take it at all. Both work. So Gabriella, I feel like, having read comments from you, I feel like you're doing good. I think you've seen some improvement here. So just stay in touch and let us know how things go. And if things are not going well, then also please stay in touch and we can talk about that. Excellent. Let us continue here and go actually backwards in time to this. Actually, it was a really nice email here. I mean, all emails are nice. I love every single email. But when I said nice, I meant that there was some good news here, which is also always so welcome when we when we're dealing with insomnia, which can be kind of a gloomy, doomy, gloomy type of problem. So everything that is positive is nice to read about. Here is from Joe. Hello from London, UK. I wanted to add to the discussion in podcast 59, episode pod 59, raised by Bebo around diet. I have found that I could barely sleep when fasting, so I do believe what you eat or what you don't eat can affect sleep negatively. I was on a ketogenic, and for a little bit of context here, in that podcast or that episode, I said that I think my opinion that I raised, what I said in that episode was that I don't believe that intermittent fasting really has any impact on sleep. So, and we'll get back to that, but that's kind of context there. So Joe said, I was on ketogenic diet for 2 years also and found that I really suffered from low blood sugar and became shaky and restless and could not sleep well at all. However, by the time I changed my diet to one which was more balanced, the anxious and chronic insomnia had set in, so I didn't see improvements in my sleep. In my opinion, this doesn't mean the diet has no effect on sleep. I think that certain diet choices or periods of not eating can be precipitating factors. But once these precipitating factors are removed, that the thoughts and behavior are perpetuating the insomnia. This can lead to the conclusion that diet has no effect on sleep. And so I'm going to stop there and just say, when I read this, I'm thinking I completely agree with that, that anything can trigger kind of initial sleeplessness, but it is the reaction to it that is the real problem. Meaning if you're not eating hardly anything at all, and you're super hungry at night, I can see how that could make you sleep less, you know? That's a state, a little bit of like fight and flight. We're hungry, we need to eat, you know. It's natural to sleep less if you're super hungry because you're supposed to be out gathering food, right? But that's not actually the problem. It's the reaction to it that is. So I think I agree 100% here. I've suffered terribly from low blood sugar, and when I tried CBTI in the past, this has had no effect because I still had low blood sugar and was very shaky. I therefore made the understandable mistake in concluding that CBTI would not work on me. Right. I had a perfect storm of precipitating factors since I also had a severe rebound insomnia from coming off beta blockers, which lasted weeks, whereas getting 5 to 15 minutes of sleep a night. This was so horrendous that my anxiety increased exponentially, probably in a PTSD kind of way. In my case, it really did take a while to remove or work out what the precipitating factors were. I'm pleased to say I've removed the obstacles now and that CBTI is having a positive effect to the point where I'm not nearly as worried or obsessed about my sleep. This is fantastic. Well done. Well done, Joe. Super, super happy to read this. So I'm not sure how well I've put it, but I guess I'm saying I think precipitating factors can be long-lived, but removing them doesn't necessarily solve the issue once they're perpetuating anxiety. 100%. This is pure insight. This is where my previous CBTI therapists have failed me before in not recognizing that the precipitating factors need to be removed since they can be purely physiological. I hear it. Okay, let's see. Anyway, pleased to report that I'm seeing big changes in sleep. Firstly, I have no doubt that I will sleep every night. I'm so unbelievably sleepy that it doesn't take long to fall asleep. I've never had an issue of dropping off though. Sleep maintenance was my issue, and I have never fell back asleep after the 1 to 3 hours sleep I was getting. I was never sleepy also. Now sleepiness is so overwhelming, I probably need to increase my sleep window. I'm still having uninterrupted sleep and can be awake for a while, but for the past 3 mornings, I've actually been asleep when my alarm goes off, which is a huge step forward. I had sleep maintenance insomnia for over 2 years, so I'm guessing it can take some weeks to months for the middle of the night awakenings to diminish. Is that your experience? Question mark. I've been doing the bedtime restriction for 3 weeks now. This is fantastic. This is amazing. I'm super happy to read this, Joe. What was I going to say? I think, I think we're seeing exactly what I'm talking about. Like Joe here is using the gas, you know, spending less time in bed, increasing the sleep drive, the need for sleep, sleepiness. But what is actually having more impact is that there's less worry, you know. But to get to a point of less worry, easing up on the brake, you often have to like really push the gas in so that when you see that I can sleep, I'm starting to sleep, I'm starting to feel sleepy, and then you're like, okay, I'm less worried, this is working. And then the whole thing just like goes like that. And Joe is on that path. It's amazing. It's amazing. 3 weeks, you know, is often, you know, it's very different. for some people, it like 1 to 2 weeks, and they're great. 3 weeks is not unusual, but very good to see this. And now that said, we know that actually Joe has had tried CBTI in the past. So 3 weeks is still like a lot of people see a lot of benefit in 3 weeks. For others, it can take more. I'd say for almost everyone does see significant improvement within the first 5 weeks, that for sure. Now that if that's not your case, don't be discouraged. It can take longer, but that's kind of typical. Question here. I've had sleep maintenance in summer for over 2 years. I'm guessing it can take weeks to month for the middle of night awakenings to diminish. True, it can definitely do that. And now, what do I want to say here? I think the most important thing to say here is this, that the more you wonder when you're not going to have those awakenings, the longer it's going to take before they go away. The faster you can get to a point where you don't even wonder if it's going to happen or not, or when you don't even wonder when you're going to be completely back to sleeping well, when you don't wonder that anymore, then it's going to speed up, right? But that said, yes, what's my experience there? I can't say I have a specific experience for this, like when does the middle of awakening stop? I can't say I have a specific, which is good. So there's no expectation, which is probably the best thing. One final question. What are your thoughts on sleep issues when approaching menopause? I have not had a single night sweat and have not reached menopause, but when my insomnia first set in, it was worse for a week or month, then it became all month. So I think hormones do play a part in disrupting sleep. However, I have made a choice to give CBTI a really good go instead of resorting to hormone replacement therapy, which would just be another sleep effort and give me side effects like every other medication supplement I've tried. I think the following, that I made an episode called The Two Arrows last week, I believe it was. I think it was actually last Friday, where somebody asked me a very similar question. And my thinking, my belief on this is that menopause, for sure, is a big trigger for sleeplessness. And I think the changes in hormones, the hot flashes, like that can definitely cause sleeplessness. But again, if you don't react to it, it becomes more contained. It becomes like a disturbance, an issue, a nuisance, but it stays that way. But when you start reacting to it, that's when it really starts to become a problem, you know? And it's interesting that, and I couldn't, for some technical reason, I couldn't pull up this tweet that I has found where there was actually an abstract, you know, like the summary of a research study where they had done CBT versus hormone replacement therapy, HRT, and some other things for insomnia related to menopause. And what was the best? CBT actually was the best. So I think just stick with what you're doing now. I mean, you're having amazing, just stick with what you're doing now. And I think, again, like these thoughts about what happens if I have menopause, what happens if, what if, the more you can get let go of the what ifs, not even think about it, the better. And then I want to read this. Finally, just to add, you and your videos are brilliant and have really, really helped me. That was so nice to read that, Joe. And I feel like your emails have been brilliant. They've helped me a lot. Thank you. And stay in touch and keep it up. Now, we have an email here from Scott, which came in 22 hours ago. Let's read it. Hi, Daniel. I just listened to your most recent podcast, and as with most of your podcasts, it certainly resonated with me. I've been dealing with insomnia for several years, and I've gone through a couple stints of CBTI and basically practice CBTI as my ongoing sleep plan. I usually get somewhere between 5 to 6 hours a night, but feel sick most days. I often will get very sleepy around 11 at night, but battle through it to stay up till midnight, which is my set bedtime. My alarm is set for 6 a.m. I'm wondering, since I have been on the recovery journey for over a year now, if I should stop watching the clock for when I should go to bed and just try going to sleep when I'm tired and get up if I'm not falling asleep. What do you think? Second, the biggest reason I have not been able to gain sleep is due to hyperarousal. Sometimes right before midnight, I will get a bout of sleep anxiety that upsets my ability to get sleep. What books would you recommend for learning to let go of these fears? Third, I often have chest pain throughout the day. I've checked with my doctor who can't seem to find anything wrong. Is it a common symptom among insomnia patients? I'm committed to resolving my insomnia drug-free. It has become the battle of my life because it does affect my daytime functioning so much. Thanks for everything you do. Please let me know if there's any way I can support your work. First of all, thank you so much for reaching out, Scott. Super, super helpful. And I hope this will be helpful to you in terms of supporting the work. Actually, I was thinking I mentioned this in the past, was for those of you who are tuning in here on a podcast, please review it. That would be really, really nice and really, really helpful. Now, that said, really good questions here. And where should we start? I think actually I want to start in the end here and saying that, you know, there's some overall, like a lot of positives here. Like Scott is recognizing that hyperarousal is a driving force, has been really doing CBTI and has really good questions. That is awesome. And now, one thing that is also awesome is I'm committed to resolving insomnia drug-free. Commitment is really good. Here though, it has become the battle of my life. When I read that, which I very often read, the struggle, the battle, the fight, you know, I'm trying to crush my insomnia, I have to beat insomnia, et cetera, like that. That, you know, having that, the only way to actually get to a point of sleeping really well is to de-escalate, to step away from the battle, not look at it as a fight. Because whenever it is a fight, insomnia always wins. Because conflict, you know, conflict leads to preoccupation, hyperarousal, and more insomnia. And then the insomnia becomes stronger, and then you battle it more, and then it becomes stronger yet. Like, you have to step away from the fight. And how do you practically do that? Well, in the questions that we're going over, all of it is really about that. But in my opinion, I think this is really important. And in my conclusion is that when somebody has trouble sleeping, I do believe that the first weeks of therapy is really about understanding sleep, understanding insomnia, learning about techniques, you know, undoing habits, or like understanding how to undo habits. And these are things like knowing that most people sleep 6 hours, knowing that sleeping little or insomnia has not been shown to have any negative health consequences, understanding what sleep drive is, understanding why one should spend less time in bed, and these kind of basic principles. Once you understand that, once you know these fundamentals, the rest of it, everything from that point on, really becomes attention shifting. Trying to do things that you enjoy in your life. Trying not to research. Trying not to Google. Trying not to give sleep any attention. That becomes really the work after the initial learning phase, in my opinion. So with that said, let's, because that actually segues really well into these questions here. And so the first question was, should I stop watching the clock for when I go to bed and just try to go to sleep when I'm tired and get up if I'm not falling asleep? I think that is absolutely the next step. I think so, for somebody like you, Scott. My good friend Michael Schwartz taught me a good way to like start phasing out of like what's called, I call sleep tight now, or a bedtime restriction or sleep restriction. So what Scott is doing here is like going to bed not before, like keeping himself up until midnight and then set an alarm for 6 a.m. Interestingly, this exact same example I use, 6 a.m. and 12. I think that's a great place to start, because when you have trouble sleeping in the beginning, you need like these rigid instructions. Do this, don't do that. Do this, don't do that, right? Because the what if, the wondering, the questioning, the researching, all that stuff is really what feeds insomnia. Now, in the beginning, that's really good, you know? And for a lot of people, it really works. So like, I stayed up till midnight, I started falling asleep, and I woke up around like this time, and that works for a lot of people. But especially when you have this hyperarousal, the sleep window thing can a little bit backfire, because you're like, oh, I'm not really sleeping now, but I gotta stay up till 12. At 12, I can sleep. Midnight, if I just make it to midnight, I can sleep. And then midnight comes, and then now you're now you're revved up. Now you want to sleep. Now you're expecting sleep. Now you're hoping to sleep, and then it doesn't happen, right? So two good options here are either just stop checking stop checking the time, or at all, now I'm getting tripped up a little bit. two good things you can do is either just kind of do what you said. You still try to get up at 6, but other than that, just go to bed when you feel sleepy. That's perfect. But what may actually be easier is this technique I learned from Michael Schwartz, which is you decide upon a time after which you actively avoid knowing what time it is. So, and that could be like, let's say 10:30. Let's say, okay, it's 10:30 now. From now on, I'm not going to check the time at all. I can do whatever I want. Like, this enjoyable. I can watch like some TV or watch a Netflix show or read, but try to avoid knowing what time it is. And the problem, like, I really am a proponent of doing things you enjoy. And oftentimes that is like watching a Netflix show or something like that. But the problem with that is like it's hard to avoid seeing what time it is. But if you can do something like that without knowing what the time it is, that's great. Or read or do whatever it is that you enjoy, and then just go by feeling. That's great. Timelessness is the cure for sleeplessness. I believe that. So I think the question best, I think, yes, that is a really good idea. Second, the hyperarousal. Sometimes right before midnight, I will get a bout of sleep anxiety that upsets my ability to sleep. What books would you recommend for learning to let go of these fears? I can't say I've come across any, well, actually, in this very moment when I'm sitting here, I'm thinking, one good book actually is this, The Sleep Book by Dr. Guy Meadows, The Sleep Book. It's based on what's called ACT, Acceptance Commitment Therapy, which is basically a technique where you don't engage with thoughts. When you feel anxious, instead of like reacting to it and thinking like, why do I feel anxious? What should I do? Then you're like, oh, I recognize this thought. This is anxiety. I've had this thought before. Kind of externalizing yourself. It takes a lot of skill, but I do believe that is the best book I can think of. But I think something that I thought about after I had read this email and thought about making this episode, my wife has talked a lot about someone named Brooke Castillo. Brooke Castillo, she's the founder of the Life Coach School, and she has a podcast. And from what my wife almost daily now, she listens to like a podcast on Work to Work, I think, and she comes back home and tells me about an episode. And I'm like, every time I'm like, this is brilliant. This is amazing. It's basically like, there are these principles like non-engagement and patience and acceptance and things like that, that I talk about, but that really are almost universally applicable to almost any problem we have. And in this Brooke Castillo, I think she must be some kind of genius. She just kind of like invented CBT by herself in a actually what I think is much more practical way than original CBT, much less academic, much more practical. So I definitely check out that podcast. It seems like you like podcasts because you're listening to mine, so that might be really good. So Brooke Castillo, the Life School Coach, I think that's a great podcast. I think you can learn a lot from that. A third, I often have chest pain during the day. Check with my doctor. Is this a common symptom among insomnia patients? Here's the thing. Hyperarousal often causes, I think, let's talk about this example. You know how a lot of us carry a cell phone in our pockets. I do. And I'm used to that like vibration when I get a message or somebody calls or something like that. Very often though, I'm like, oh, somebody messaged me. I look at my phone, nothing there. It's what happens is that I've become, my brain is kind of like conditioned to look out for this vibration. And even when it's not there, sometimes my brain just like produces it. And I think that is a little bit of like hyperarousal. Like my brain is like trained to look for it. And with general hyperarousal, things that normally wouldn't even be noticeable can be very noticeable, and sometimes to a point where it causes like pain and things like that. So I would say it's very common for people with insomnia to have jerks, to have tingling, to have twitching, to have discomfort. And yes, I've heard pain before. I haven't, can't say I heard chest pain, but I heard like this kind of belly pain I've heard. And so I think hyperarousal can cause a lot of things, including pain. That can be the, definitely can cause pain. Yeah. Or the sense, yeah, which is a sensation, the sensation of pain. Yeah. So Scott, thanks for reaching out, and I hope this helped. And if you have any follow-up questions, any clarifications needed or anything like that, please email again. All right. So that was Scott. And okay, here, somebody's putting me on the spot here with some really, really challenging questions, and it is none but Vince from the Philippines. Hi, Daniel. I've been researching CBTI a lot and found out the C cognitive means that you don't necessarily believe the thought that comes into your mind, and B means how you interpret or what actions we do about the thought. I really want more details about this, so could you give me the correct reaction to a number of thoughts that I list? Thank you. Really, really cool. I love the fact that you did this research, and that's well done. And big picture here, yeah, it's like Vincent says here, like CBT is really all structured around that kind of central hypothesis or thought, or that how we feel is ultimately the product of a thought or a belief. And if you know that, if you understand that, then you can get to the root of it. You can find kind of the thought that's producing a belief, and the thought that's producing a feeling that is producing an action. So the feeling's producing an action, right? So if you go back to the thought and work with it and challenging it and find evidence for and against it, then if you can change the thought, then you can change how you feel, and you can change your action. You can feel, you can change everything. Like if you can change your thought, or if you can change your thought and work with it, great. Or if you can just change your thought, like I'm thinking about this, this is making me anxious, and that makes me, you know, do something I don't want to do. Well, then if you can just switch it, like, let me think about something else, let me do something else, switch attention, then the whole thing, the feeling, the action, everything can change. So that's kind of a little bit of CBT, big, you know, big picture. Now, let's look at these three questions here. Number one, I didn't sleep yesterday. What if it happens today? There's many ways to approach this, but let's see if we really try to apply, try to really answer the question. Could you give me the correct reaction to number of thoughts? Well, I don't necessarily that there is just one correct reaction, of course, but I didn't sleep yesterday. What if it happens today? I think there to immediately it comes to mind is like two things here. One is that doesn't work here. No, let's skip that one. Let's go with the what if. So I think in this scenario, the concern is, well, I didn't sleep yesterday. What if it happens today again? So the what if then becomes, I think a good reaction to this is using the so what. So what if it happens today again, then so what? Well, then I might feel terrible. Then so what? Well, then I'm not going to be able to do my work. And if you do this, which is called the downward arrow technique, then it kind of leads you in two directions. Either you do the so what, you question everything, like what if that happens? Well, then so what? What if so what? Then it takes you down the path of, well, actually, that's not so bad. The outcome is not so bad. So I guess it's not really that big of a problem. And that's good, right? And if it goes the other direction and you go like, if I can't sleep, then I'm going to feel really terrible. I'm not going to do my job. I'm going to be fired. I'm going to become homeless. It leads you to this terrible outcome. Well, then that's kind of where the C comes in. Then you question that like belief or that, you know, that thought, like how likely is it that I'm going to become homeless because I can't sleep? It's not that likely, you know? So when you do the downward arrow technique like that and like question every what if, then it leads you to a good place either way. And by the way, I've been meaning to do a specific Insomnia Insight episode on that, this what I just talked about, so that it will come up at some point. But so I didn't really become a classic questioning the thought in this episode, in this question, but I think there will come one. And so that was number one. Number two, can I cope? We're going to work with 2 days with no sleep. And here's where you do the kind of classic CBT thing where you have this belief that you probably cannot go to work with 2 days with no sleep. And then you try to find evidence to the contrary, you know, or both ways. Like, you know, is that true? Is it true that I cannot go today to work with 2 days of no sleep? Has it happened in the past? If you have gone to work after 2 days of no sleep, then you already have the evidence you need. No, that's not true. That thought or belief is not true. If you have gone, if it happened that 2 days you didn't sleep and then you didn't go to work, then it becomes like, but could I have gone to work? What would have happened if I did go to work? Maybe I actually could have gone to work. So maybe that belief that I can't go to work if I can't sleep for 2 days is not true. I think that's really how you address that one. Number three, I'm on medication to go to sleep. Can I someday remove all this meds and be a natural sleeper? Yeah, I think the way you approach this one is like the central belief here is that I can't or maybe cannot go to sleep without medications. And this is something I talk about a lot, which is the only thing that can actually make you sleep is your own natural sleep drive. And how can you prove that? Well, you can do this thought experiment. You can say, let's say I'm taking trazodone every night and I sleep for, you know, 6 hours. Well, what would happen, you know, if I took it every 6 hours? Would I then sleep 24/7? No, of course not. That wouldn't happen. You'd sleep the same. You'd sleep but 6 hours. And that proves that medications cannot produce sleep. And when you start, you know, realizing that, well, then it is easy to see actually that, you know, if the medications are not producing sleep, that it means I am producing the sleep, which means I can sleep without it and I could become a natural sleeper. Cool. I hope that's helpful. It felt like pretty decent answers, but let me know what you felt, Vincent. And thanks so much for contributing. Thank you. Amber talked about that one. And I have this feeling that I'm missing something, but there's nothing here. And I checked there. Let's go to the comment section. If I said I was going to make a reply and I missed something here, then please send me an email or comment again. Monday. Okay. Now we're going to the comment section and, I think here, yeah, Gabrielle, we talked about that. So I think there's two more, which is first Jules. Yeah. Jules said the following in a comment to episode 246. Hi, Daniel. I think I'm going to do a functional MRI scan to make sure I don't have fatal insomnia because I'm really starting to panic because I have on average maybe 4 to 5 hours of sleep a night and I'm extremely exhausted most of the time. Maybe when it turns out that everything's fine and I don't have fatal insomnia, I would sleep better. So a couple of things here. One is the, you know, I said we would talk about a little bit about fatigue today. Fatigue is one of those kind of non-specific things that can happen for a million reasons. You know, sometimes when we're depressed, we feel fatigued. Sometimes when we're anxious, we feel fatigued. Sometimes when we're overworked, we feel fatigued. Sometimes when we're underworked, we feel fatigued. Sometimes when we take medications, we feel sometimes we don't medicate. Like they can all, anything and nothing can cause fatigue. And now, the thing with that is if there's no obvious reason why I feel fatigued, then yes, it's always important to talk to your doctor and maybe have some examinations and whatnot. But if you are, let's say you're waiting to do an MRI scan or you're waiting to do something like that, then maybe it's helpful to, for a time being, like maybe say I'm in good hands with my doctor. I don't necessarily need to try to figure out why this fatigue is coming from and rather try to do something to feel less fatigued, you know? And what would that be? When really, I believe that for most people, the best thing to do when you're fatigued is kind of the opposite of what you feel you should do. Meaning you should be active, you know, meet your friends, do something you enjoy, something new, something you never tried. And maybe if that sounds like, well, I cannot do that, then maybe take baby steps. Be like, tomorrow I'm going to take a 15-minute walk, you know, and then you do that and you're like, I actually could do that. And I felt pretty good about it. Tomorrow I'm going to do a 30-minute walk. And then you realize, like, oh, I can do this. Your confidence grows. You just feel a little bit less fatigued. And you're like, suddenly you're doing more and more. That's a great approach, I think, often. And then another thing is like, as Yul says here, maybe when it turns out that everything's fine, I would sleep better. That maybe, but why wait? You know, why not do things already today that could make you feel better and sleep better? And what are those things? Well, it's what I always talk about here, you know, initially, like, spend less time in bed, be active, shift attention, you know. And one more thing I wanted to add was, you know, I sleep 4 to 5 hours per night, which is actually, you know, you may need to sleep much more to feel refreshed. You may need a full, like, 7 hours, which is, you know, the kind of longer end of the spectrum. But a lot of people sleep, like, most people sleep between 5.5 to, you know, 7 hours, kind of average for adults. So you're not terribly far off from that, which is great, which is good. I hope this all was helpful, Jules. And hang in there and stay in touch. So that said, I think there was maybe one more. Neil, thanks for commenting. Joe, thanks so much for commenting. And where is it? Oh, Family Design, thanks for sharing. And Ellen also, thanks for everything. So yeah, here's the last one. This is from Rishav. This is a comment on episode 265 here. It says, sir, I lost my job because of this insomnia thing. If I have one sleepless night, I worry so much that I cannot sleep the next and the next. Help me. I'm really sorry to hear this, Rishav. And when somebody shares something like that with me, it's the real problem, you know, is always when insomnia has taken something. And a classic one, which is of course much much more benign, much less of a problem than what you're describing here, but people give up coffee, for example. Like, I'm not going to drink coffee because that can hurt how I sleep. Well, that's never a good strategy, unless, you know, it's obvious, like you're drinking like a lot of coffee at 6 p.m. and you know you shouldn't do that. Well, then don't do that, of course. But if you're not sure what's going on, you're like, I'm not gonna drink coffee, that's a give to the insomnia. The insomnia gets more power, it has more power of your life, and they just go stronger, and it's never saturated. The more you give, the more it wants, you know. And when we have this, you know, I don't know anything about your situation, Rishav, so this may come across as like not applicable at all, but it's really good to question if it, like, you know, was it, what were there any other reasons why I no longer have that job, or was it simply because, you know, of the insomnia? Because the key here is that to work with the beliefs and to find that, you know, if you believe that it was the insomnia that made me lose my job, then you're giving the insomnia so much power. You know, when you can find that, you know, actually, I didn't really love that job. And if I really loved my job, I probably could have kept it and powered through it. Then it becomes very different. Then it becomes like, it wasn't insomnia. It was actually, I didn't like the job. Then it's like, oh, that just removes so much power from the insomnia. So if you can find a reason or change your belief, and find that, you know, it was actually another reason, it wasn't insomnia, then you've taken a lot of power back from the insomnia. That's something that's really, 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 really important. Now, another thing in this that Richard describes here, if I have one sleepless night, I worry so much. That's the kind of PTSD part of insomnia, that somebody that had like real trouble sleeping, when you just have one sleepless night, then it's like, this is it. The insomnia's back. All the terrible things that happened are going to happen again. Well, that's another one where you have to really work and question that belief. And a really important thing here is like knowing that everyone, every single human being has sleepless nights when something stressful happens. That is normal. Everyone has that, you know? So if you are somebody that has intermittent trouble sleeping, or you've done better for a while and then you have a sleepless night, then that doesn't mean anything. It just means that you react like everybody does react, you know? And I felt there was one more thing I want to say here. And also, like, yeah, it's the, you know, that reaction. Yeah. I felt the one more thing that I'm forgetting here. If I have one sleepless night, I worry so much that I cannot sleep the next time. But you have insight here. You know, it's the worrying about not sleeping is actually what feeds it. So I think another important thing becomes to actually find evidence to the contrary. Find that time, even if it's this one single outlier, find that time where you had a sleepless night, and then the next night you actually slept good. If you can just find one of those instances, then you know that the belief that if you have one sleepless night, it's just going to go on is not a true belief. It's not true. And when you know that that's not true, then the whole construct can come down. So other than that, Richard, I say, like, you know, listen to more here, or find somebody to work with, a CBTI coach or something like that. I think all the information you need is here, but sometimes you just need maybe a little more guidance and support from somebody. That could be something to think about too. So that said, we'll conclude here. I want to thank everyone for the questions here. And if you have any question, please leave a comment or email me, daniel@insomniainsight.co. And with that said, I hope you have a really nice weekend. Chrissy, nice seeing you. I hope you have a really nice weekend, and I will be back tomorrow. Until then, take it easy.